This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Twenty-five years ago, New Hampshire became the first state with no central institution for people with disabilities and mental illness after the closing of the Laconia School. A system of community and home-based care was supposed to be ready and waiting for folks who might not be able to live independently. And to some extent, that did happen. But sometimes a thread in this fabric breaks, and there aren't the right services available close by. So that's where places like the Lakeview Neuro Rehabilitation Center in Effingham, New Hampshire, stepped in. Lakeview and other similar facilities around the country are for-profit institutions that provide residential care for people with a wide array of disabilities that families turn to, often because they have no other option. But it turns out Lakeview has a troubled history, including allegations of abuse and neglect, so serious that it shut down earlier this year. However, as NHPR's Jack Rodolico has reported, that's far from the end of the story, both here in New Hampshire and other states with similar facilities and similar problems. Today in The Exchange, a mountain of misconduct at Lakeview and what wider systemic problems its story reveals. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And our guests are Jack Rodolico, NHPR's health and science reporter. He has been reporting on Lakeview for over a year and co-reported an hour-long investigative program about the broader system this month with the investigative show Reveal. Jack, thanks again for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Laura.
Joining us from D.C., Kurt Decker. He's executive director of the National Disability Rights Network. That's the membership organization for local groups like the New Hampshire Disability Rights Center, which was involved in the Lakeview investigations. And Kurt Decker, very good to have you, too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, and to you first, Jack, what's the bigger picture here beyond this one facility and the relatively small group of people that it served?
Well, and it was a relatively small group. There are 88 beds at Lakeview, and about a quarter of those beds at any given time were filled with New Hampshire residents. So it's a pretty small slice of the population. And what Lakeview turned into over time, you know, when it originally opened, it was a traumatic brain injury facility. That's a particular type of disability with a particular spectrum of recovery. Not the same thing as autism and developmental disabilities. Very, very different conditions. Yet, as the state cut back on some services for people with autism and other complex developmental disabilities, particularly people with disabilities and mental illness, those individuals increasingly found themselves at Lakeview because the state couldn't find the psych unit, couldn't find the group home. The family couldn't support their son or daughter at home anymore. And so when that little thread in the when that thread in the network of care gave out for an individual, they would wind up at Lakeview's doorstep. And the goal was always to keep them there for a brief period of time, get them back into the community because Lakeview was an institutional setting. I mean, there were a number of experts. They described themselves as residential many times, but when a number of different experts went in there, they saw an institution.
And we're not supposed to have that, right?
Yes and right. I mean, you know, a hospital is an institution. It is not necessarily inherently bad to have an institution, right, because we all might need that at some point. But we're not supposed to have people living in institutions. And so some people wound up getting stuck at Lakeview because, their parent would send them from New York State, for example. New York, there was a big pipeline of clients from New York State paid for by taxpayer money, Medicaid, public education. And when New York couldn't find a placement, they would send them to Lakeview. You know, as perspective, New York has something like 400 or 300 individuals with severe disabilities placed out of New York State. A handful of those were almost always at Lakeview. So if you don't, if you're using a place as your last resort for care for someone with complex disabilities, they go there. And that's not necessarily solving the real problem, which is not necessarily that person's behavior, which might be aggressive. They might have a history of sexual offenses, or they might not. They might not have any of those issues. They might just not have the care they particularly need at that moment in time at home. So you send them to an institution. You're not fixing the problem back in the community.
And so
that's the conundrum that the state still has. Even though Lakeview has closed, we still have individuals at out-of-state facilities. The same clientele that would have wound up at Lakeview are now at facilities in Florida, for example, some that have, I mean, objectively worse track records than Lakeview and longer track records than Lakeview. But, you know, the state is trying to build up some of these services, group homes, and other opportunities for people to stay at home. But, you know, that's a laborious and slow process.
So you could almost say, Jack, with the closing of Lakeview, instead of patting ourselves on the back and saying, hey, this facility has all sorts of problems, hey, we finally shut it down, in a way, it could almost be worse for some of these folks because now they're being treated at places far outside of state. Family members can't keep an eye on things.
Right. And there's two interesting arguments around that point. One is that was an argument that Lakeview and many others used to keep Lakeview open, that if we are not open, then these individuals have nowhere else to go, which to an extent was true. And as Lakeview has closed, a report from the governor's office found that instead of going to Lakeview, we've got people going to prison, to nursing homes, and to psychiatric units, not appropriate environments for these individuals in most cases. But the other side of that is an institution with the track record that Lakeview has, as documented by many authorities, could not stay open. The state, in good conscience, could not keep them open, and that's why they shut them down.
So that's a systemic issue. I'd love to hear what you see at the national level as well, Kurt. What do stories like the Lakeview story that Jack has been working on for so long and other facilities around the country, what do they tell us about this system?
I believe it tells us that while we've made great progress and we've tried, we've learned that large congregate institutions don't work very well for the vast majority of people with disabilities, we haven't gone to the next step, which is creating good quality community services to allow folks who do have some severe disabilities and may have some behavioral problems and who need very formalized care, that those places don't exist enough around the country to allow both them to receive the care they need, but also to live in the most integrated setting. As a result, we've created this crisscrossing of the country of various states sending and other states receiving these kids and adults. And we believe at the national level this is a very serious problem because, one, a person sent out of state is away from their family, away from their early life. And secondly, it's very difficult for the state that's sending to monitor and make sure that the people are getting, in fact, what the state's paying for and what the facility is claiming they're doing.
You know, Jack used the term last resort, Kurt, and families certainly often feel like there's no place for their child. This is the last resort. I've also heard people, though, call some of these facilities dumping grounds for places that, you know, society just doesn't know what to do with. What do you think?
Well, I agree. We can't blame the parents. The parents are really at their wit's end often with a child or an adult with a very serious behavior problem, and they're looking for services, and they're entitled to those services. The fact that the state that they live in hasn't stepped up to the plate and actually developed those resources puts them in a very difficult position, and they're often left with this facility that they hear about. And some of these facilities are very clever in terms of their marketing. It sounds terrific, and the parent really wants to believe that that is a good place for their relative and accepts that. But unfortunately, in our work around the country where we go into these places, and as Jack has documented, the reality just is not what is being portrayed often in their marketing campaigns.
The number for you to join us here in The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in The Exchange, we're following up on some investigative reporting from NHPR and the radio show Reveal about a history of abuse and neglect at Lakeview and other similar facilities nationwide, but also more broadly what this shows us about our system for people with developmental disabilities, brain injuries, mental health issues. What are your experiences with the system here in the Granite State? Where do you see facilities like Lakeview fitting in? And what do you think we learn from this whole story? Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, gentlemen, and to you first, Jack, I think, connect Lakeview and its opening years back to this nationwide event that you've said New Hampshire was on the forefront of these big institutions for people with developmental disabilities and mental illness here in New Hampshire. The Laconia School's famous. These were closing. Everybody was going to do this in the community. But then Lakeview opens. Just connect the arc of that narrative for
us,
please.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating story. So there were two parallel narratives happening in the state at the time. And here's the kicker for me, right, that really connects this. Around the same time, New Hampshire was patting itself on the back, and reasonably so. I mean, I don't mean that facetiously, for closing its state-run institution for people with disabilities. Within a year, a facility in Effingham, New Hampshire, which under previous ownership, same facility as Lakeview, was raided by the FBI.
Okay. Raided
by the FBI. Okay, so what are those two stories? On the one hand, we had New Hampshire was like all of these other states, and most states still have a state-run institution. They're smaller, where people were warehoused from the 50, from the early 1900s into the 70s in particular. Individuals with disabilities, often when they were born, a doctor might come into the room to the mother and say, "Your child has Down syndrome. They should be sent to an institution. You might not even want to see your child." And that, some mothers didn't go for that, but some did because it was the advice of the doctor. So this system built up over the course of decades until it hit its breaking point. And we started shutting down these institutions in New Hampshire and building community-based system. At the same time, private companies, for-profit and nonprofit, started to grow to serve this population. Okay, and we decided at that time that the state was not doing a good job, which was pretty true. So the private sector stepped in. At that time, Lakeview was called High Watch. Lakeview is still on High Watch Road in Effingham, New Hampshire, and it was a facility for people with traumatic brain injuries. And it was owned by a family called the Brennicks. And we can get in a little bit. I think we'll get into their backstory, but 1992 was when that company, New Medico, this was the family's company, New Medico, was at its peak. They had over 40 facilities for brain injuries around the country. Lakeview was one of those facilities. The corruption at New Medico was so systemic. The fraud and the abuse of clients was so systemic that the FBI raided the facility. The FBI raided the facility after Congress specifically investigated New Medico. This was a time when in the late 70s, early 80s, we went from something like 90% of people dying from brain injuries to 90% surviving. Brand new patient population. Nobody quite knew what to do with
them.
They
survived because airbags, better emergency rooms.
Better emergency rooms, medevac. All of this modern technology, which saved a lot of lives, it left people traumatized, their brains traumatized. And so what were we going to do with them? In steps New Medico. And New Medico expanded rapidly. They made billions and billions of dollars. And in the process, they created a network where they marketed in hospitals, and they were a predatory marketing company. I mean, this was documented by Congress that really just shuffled people into these facilities all around the country, but mostly on the East Coast. They kept them for as long as their insurance would pay, and then they kicked them out. And in the meantime, the services were abysmal. And so these families were furious. And so they went to they finally got Congress to investigate. I think there were two congressional investigations. The FBI raided, and the company kind of evaporated in around 1992. after from 1992, they sold to another company. It was like this 3 years. We couldn't. This is one of the things we couldn't figure out. There was this other company that owned Lakeview for 3 years. Numedico sold to that company for $1. They sold the High Watch facility for $1.
$1?
So we assume, I think, you know, I'm not, I don't know who that was. But then in 1995, this shadowy company sold to Lakeview. And as best we could tell, a lot of the same types of practices. It's not as well documented as it was with Numedico, but a lot of the same practices happened. Aggressive marketing to parents, allegations of abuse and fraud.
Fraud meaning Medicaid and
Medicaid and private insurance and private insurance fraud to some extent.
Okay, we'll pick up on that thread in just a moment. But I also want to get our listeners involved, gentlemen. The exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Kurt Decker, Jack Rodolico, Tom's joining us from Bedford. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi. Good morning.
Go ahead, Tom.
Excuse me?
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, yeah, okay. So I have a family member that was actually a resident at one of the local area agency's own residence hall homes. And some of the difficulties we were having were very similar to some of the issues that were mentioned in the Reveal article and some of the other articles that Jack had written and I'd heard over the past year regarding, you know, services being billed for but not being rendered. You know, there are assessments that are done, they're never followed through on. There are a lot of things that really are wrong, even within the agency that's distributing the aid that actually pays these other facilities to take care of these the different brain injury residents. Part of my concern is that with these facilities that are within the agency, because they're not licensed, they're only certified, they don't fall under the same scrutiny as the Lakeviews and the other facilities that are actually licensed that the state does come in and review and monitor. So even within the own area agency, these things are going on, but because they don't have the same oversight, it seems like there's no, you know, no way to monitor them properly.
Well, we should definitely talk about the oversight, Tom. That's a huge chunk. If I could just ask you a quick question. So you have a relative who is in a residential facility right now, Tom? Do I understand that correctly?
She is. She actually was just moved from the facility that she was in because she was asked to leave, and this came after we actually started asking questions about drug testing, you know, oversight, the monitoring of, you know, services. I mean, there's, I could go on all day with things that have been going on with this place. The place she's in now, we're perfectly happy with.
Okay.
And we're satisfied to this point with them because they actually do a competent and sufficient job.
Wow. Well, Tom, thank you for telling us your story. It's a struggle, and good luck. And I did want to ask both of you gentlemen about oversight. And in general, Kurt Decker, who is in charge of making sure that what needs to go on actually does go on? Our caller mentions some places are licensed, others are certified. Now, to the average person, it sounds like the same thing, but I guess not.
Well, the caller is exactly right. And it does raise the question about how strong our monitoring system is. I do think the disability community has suffered from the very earliest days of, you know, a society that wanted to put people with disabilities out of the way and not looked at. And that has created, I think, a system that doesn't have the level of monitoring and oversight that's required, especially as we bring people into the community. We don't want to repeat the mistakes of the past where we thought we were doing a good thing by putting people in large congregate facilities. And then as we, New Hampshire did bring them out, but then failed really to make sure that the community system was of a quality that people deserved and didn't build in those kinds of protections. And there is a patchwork of licensing, monitoring. There are certification agencies. My programs around the country are funded by the federal government to provide some of that oversight. But if we're not vigilant, all of these great concepts and good ideas then just fall away. And I think the situation we're talking about exacerbates it when you put people, you know, hundreds of miles away from their families, their home, and you're just adding then another layer of potential risk when you don't have the ability to look at folks. Now, we want people to be independent, and we don't want to invade their privacy, but we have an obligation to make sure that these people are protected, that they're getting the services that they deserve, and that the services
are being paid for. I'm going to jump in on you there. I apologize. And Tom, thank you very much for your call. Stay with us. A lot more coming up. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're following up on an investigative program from NHPR and the radio show Reveal about the history of abuse and neglect at Lakeview Neurorehabilitation Center and other similar facilities nationwide. We're looking at that, but also more broadly, what the problems at Lakeview say about our broader system for caring for people with brain injuries, developmental disabilities, and in some cases, mental illness. Join us with your personal experiences, questions, comments, concerns, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Suzanne, Kurt, and Jack. She says, this hour-long program on Reveal, again, that's the investigative report you did, Jack, last week, was so utterly appalling. She says there should be a list of medical criminals, abusive patients, Medicare fraud, such as we have for sex offenders, to keep the owners from closing and just reopening elsewhere. Or, Suzanne says, perhaps the offending business owners could be sentenced to stay in their own facilities. This gets back to what Tom was saying, our caller earlier, gentlemen. And Kurt, I'll start with you. The accountability piece, it seems like accountability monitoring has not been terrific. Go ahead, Kurt.
Well, I would agree. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is the major funding source for most of these services around the country, very much rely on the states to certify that the state is spending the money appropriately and providing the necessary oversight. The state then relies on other accrediting bodies and sort of very loose oversight, and that is just a recipe for disaster. It allows these facilities that are created supposedly for good purposes to pretty much run the way they'd like. For example, as Jack said, New York is notorious for spending millions of dollars a year, sending children and adults all over the country, 300 people with brain injury in Massachusetts, a bunch of children to the Judge Rottenberg Center in Rhode Island, where they shock people on an hourly basis, and very little in the way of accountability or oversight from the state that's sending or from the state that's receiving.
So even someone with no personal connection to this issue has a stake, Kurt, because of the mostly Medicaid funding, right? Are we talking Medicare, too, or mostly Medicaid?
Absolutely. We ask Congress constantly for additional funding for services to people with disabilities. And as a result, we feel that this money has to be spent appropriately and properly for the purposes it was intended. Otherwise, we will get the kind of backlash that I think we're getting in some quarters, that the entitlement programs are out of control and there's too much money being wasted. So this will ultimately not only hurt people with disabilities, but it is violating the public trust that is spending many billions of dollars to provide services to this very vulnerable population.
Toward that end, Jack, in your reporting, you spoke with Danny Adams. He's a former weekend manager at Lakeview. He said Lakeview's officials, his words, didn't want patients to leave or get better, but to keep them there as long as possible to continue collecting public money. And Danny describes to you, Jack, in this cut we're going to hear, how employees were instructed to milk the most Medicaid dollars from patients. This is quite revealing. Let's hear.
This is how it was done. If there was a TV on in the main room of the house and there was more than one individual watching that TV, they could bill for a social interaction group.
What he's saying is Lakeview was sending a bill to Medicaid for plopping a few clients in front of a TV. And after a couple of hours,
they would change the channel and figure out between the individuals who were watching the TV if that channel was acceptable for them. So there's 2 hours of billing for community decision making and so on. So
Wait a minute. So you're saying the decision of choosing the show was billed as a service?
Yes. It's like it was a matching game. All right, what does this activity match? Let's put it in that. Boom.
Again, that's Danny Adams, former Lakeview employee, talking about Medicaid and how claims were filed at Lakeview. We are looking at this specific story of how this neurorehabilitation center in New Hampshire was closed down, but also the bigger, broader issues that this raises about our whole system for caring for folks with complex needs. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Karen is in Madison. Hi, Karen. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning.
I'm also an ex-employee of the facility back in the early 90s when it was High Watch.
Okay. We were just talking about that. Sure. Go ahead, Karen.
I'm familiar with the, some of the struggles with the clients and the nature of the care. And this is one of my concerns. In the town of Madison, there are two group homes that have opened up from a company that claims to be a nonprofit called Beckett Academy. They're buying homes in residential areas and having clients with these same struggles. Some that I understand were from High Watch. They're coming living in the community, and I'm certainly not without empathy. I mean, they need a nice, safe place to live. But it was done very underhandedly. None of the neighbors were aware that a group home was opening up in the town. The previous owner of the house, it's my understanding, was misinformed about the planned usage of the house. There was some special permitting that was necessary for them, for the town of Madison, that they refused to comply with. There were a couple of meetings with the zoning board, and it got to the point where it would have had to go on to court. And our little town couldn't afford those legal fees or chose not to go any further with it. So now we have at least two group homes, rumor possibly of another, coming into neighborhoods. And I guess my question is this another kind of an underhanded way to take advantage of these folks and the clients, with their settlements and insurance? I know that they have a separate party that purchases the homes.
Karen, if I could ask you, and we'll definitely talk about sort of Lakeview's closed and what's springing up to take its place and whether that's a good thing or not. But if I could ask you just broadly, it's great that you called, given that we're talking about Lakeview and all the repercussions and you used to work there. What were some of the impressions that you had about the quality of care at Lakeview when you were there in the 90s, Karen?
Well, it was really challenging because there was a lot of aggressive behavior. And there was training that had to take place to try and contain that. And it was restraining at times. The clients came from all over the world.
Wow.
So, I mean, there was royalty there from, I believe, Saudi Arabia. There was a client that was a motorcycle star that had had an accident. And just some really extreme cases that were tragic, but there was no way that they could live at home, and certainly not in a community setting, that they needed to one-on-one, 24-hour care to keep them from harming themselves or others.
Thank you so much for calling in, Karen, and we'll pick up on your points. To her second point, first, Jack Rodolico, Lakeview often said, well, these folks are aggressive and they can't live anywhere else. And certainly, it would be very challenging for parents to have some of these older kids at home. But you've got some insight on that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I talked with a lot of families who said I could not care for my child at home, son, or more often son, but daughters as well.
Yeah, as they got bigger and stronger.
There seemed to be a propensity of young men with autism who are over 250 pounds that went through Lakeview in recent years. And you can imagine the type of scenario that if you've got someone who's nonverbal, who has trouble communicating, gets frustrated when they can't communicate, when people don't understand them. But the bigger problem here, right, is, okay, so let's say someone has aggressive behaviors. What was going on at Lakeview is that Lakeview was consistently promising state agencies who are going to be paying them. And the average payment for Lakeview is $292,000 per year.
Wow.
It was $300,000, and it often was more, sometimes $1,000 a day for the care there. And for that package of $1,000 a day, you're supposed to be getting education, you're supposed to be getting intensive psychological treatment, and importantly, in many situations, you're supposed to get a one-to-one staff member, okay? One person with that individual 24/7. That didn't happen all the time. all the time. I mean, I talked with staff members who said I was constantly put into a dangerous situation where I was told to be a one-on-one for three clients who were all supposed to have one-on-ones. And so if you have to go put out a fire over here, someone's really having an issue, your attention disappears. When your attention disappears from someone who needs a one-on-one, here are things that happened at Lakeview regularly. People disappeared in the woods. Someone disappeared for 2 days and was found on top of a mountain with hypothermia. People were sexually assaulted. That happened all the time. Clients were sexually assaulted by other clients. Staff were sexually assaulted by clients. I've heard stories about staff members sexually assaulting clients. So when Lakeview failed to provide that one-to-one service, and I've asked them about this numerous times, they've never answered the question, did they bill for those services? Staff say that they did. The owners didn't say anything. That's when, you know, it's very easy to have a blanket statement that says these people are aggressive. But when you're promising care for people who have a tough time communicating and then you don't deliver on that care, it created this cauldron of problems up on this mountain in Effingham. To her other point about Beckett, so I've been into those group homes. I've interviewed the people that run these group homes in Madison. They are filled with Lakeview clients. The broader context here is that Lakeview's struggles have been a growth opportunity for other companies because somebody has to serve this population. Lakeview previously had about, I can't remember the exact number, but about 10 group homes in that area. They had the big facility and then another maybe 80 beds or 50 beds scattered around in these other group homes. When Lakeview started to have trouble, they sold all their group homes off to one company, a company called Neuro Restorative. Their parent company is the Mentor Network. Their parent company is the Civitas. They're a publicly traded company. They're probably the largest company in the country that deals with people with autism and developmental disabilities. And they grow as states shutter their institutions. They see it as a growth. They've talked to their investors as it is a growth opportunity. Beckett, the trouble with, Beckett essentially moved in as a nonprofit and bought these homes. Because of our era of deinstitutionalization, when we shut down our public institutions, there were laws that allowed group homes like Beckett to open without consulting neighbors. And so Beckett—
And we hear the concern from our caller.
And you can I can see it from both sides. If your neighbor's moving in, you want to know who that is, especially if they are a private business moving into a home in a residential area. At the same time, they have no legal obligation to tell their neighbors, and you could even assume that they might be discriminated against. So when these group homes open, there is always a problem locally because neighbors don't like— You know, they feel like the wool's been pulled over their eyes and they have to learn from the back end that they really, you know, they have all the legal rights to open where they want.
Well, a little bit later, I want to ask both of you about this whole idea of for-profit institutions versus nonprofit institutions versus state-run institutions, because each sector seems to have its own challenges. But let's go back to our listeners for a moment. Laura joins us from Center Harbor. Hi, Laura. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
I just wanted some comments on an article I read in the newspaper maybe about a week and a half ago, saying that the former owners of Lakeview are planning to reopen the facility.
As a substance abuse facility? Is that what you heard, Laura?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much for calling in. And Jack, to you, and then Kurt. Go ahead, Jack. The idea that Lakeview may be reapplying for a license to do something else.
So yeah, that's exactly what they appear to be doing. So they made some efforts to start new corporations, again, owned by the same people, run by the same people, at the same address, purporting to work with the same vulnerable population, people with disabilities and brain injuries. That didn't work out so well. The state rejected, DOE, Department of Education, rejected a license. So now what they're doing is they're partnering with a local nonprofit, faith-based group, to try to reopen as a substance abuse treatment facility. I am in the process of trying to see what the state thinks about that. This is a company that the state just spent a year pouring a lot of resources into shutting down in the state of New Hampshire because ultimately the state's conclusion was that they were incompetent, that they could not handle this population. And so now Lakeview has never answered any questions about somebody died there. Somebody was allegedly raped there. There were multiple sexual assaults. So there was a gun found on the site in June. 2 months later, they're saying they're going to be opening as a substance abuse treatment facility right at a time when the state is desperate, absolutely desperate for inpatient beds for people who are addicted to opioids. So we don't really know how this is going to play out yet.
Well, Laura, thank you for the call. And we did reach out to DHHS and Lakeview. They weren't able to provide anyone to join us today. What do you think about this more broadly, Kurt Decker, the idea of, you know, facilities are closed down, but then communities are desperate for these substance abuse treatment services, and there is a facility there. There's maybe a staff with some expertise. It might not be quite the right expertise, but I just wonder what you think more broadly about this, Kurt, and whether you see this happening anywhere else.
Well, unfortunately, we do see it happening. The providers, these, as has been described, are like shapeshifters. As soon as they're very good at gaming the system. And so I go back to putting the responsibility on the state agencies to beef up their ability to monitor what's going on, why these people aren't on disbarment lists in each state, and that the states share that information so that someone just can't move to another state and reopen under a different name. The questions of the quality of the staff, even though they're charging, as Jack said, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Yeah, I'm sure if you check to see the salary of the direct care staff, it's minimal. And bringing in people who don't have either the training or the supports to work with admittedly very difficult clients. What's unfortunate about what the community is seeing is the failure of the system, and then it stigmatizes the disability community. So then you do get this sort of NIMBY approach, not in my backyard, where a group home is being sited in a neighborhood, and just by virtue of the fact that it's a home for people with disabilities, the neighbors become incredibly concerned and can rise up and try to object. We've certainly made that illegal through the Fair Housing Act, that you can't use zoning laws to restrict people. But in fact, more wealthy communities, which have a lot of resources, can really push back. And then what happens is an awful lot of the group homes that are being created are in the poorest, worst neighborhoods. And so once again, we are failing the people with disabilities and the whole concept of quality community life.
Well, and on this issue of accountability, Jack Rodolico, again, DHHS is supposed to keep an eye on these facilities. But what did DHHS say to you as you were doing this reporting about how and why some of these things happened? I'm just wondering what they said, and then I have another question for you.
Well, so ultimately, Commissioner Nick Tumpa said it was a failure of communication, that within the Department of Health and Human Services, there were 4 or 5 offices or agencies that had some oversight responsibility at Lakeview, and they all sort of had a piecemeal approach. They looked at one narrow slice of the pie. They were supposed to be communicating with each other so that if, you know, the abuse inspectors are saying, hey, we're getting a call a week, and the licensing inspectors are saying, hey, we're seeing serious problems when we go do our inspections, there were supposed to be they basically broke it down to poor communication. But the thing – after I did that interview with Commissioner Tumpas, we started digging deeper, and we found out that essentially from the day Lakeview opened – there were serious, serious problems of abuse and fraud going on back into the 90s under the current ownership and the current management. Some of the same people that ran the facility up within the last few months were running the facility back then. And so, you know, this was a really serious systemic oversight problem.
Did DHHS have the staffing to do the oversight? Because every years, it seems like we keep reading that there's, you know, 20 fewer people, 30 fewer people, 50 fewer people, 100 fewer people. I mean, at some level, can you get enough bodies out there to investigate this stuff?
You're absolutely right. And that's something that I think you can't bring up enough. So you can point at the state agency and say, why didn't you do your job? Okay. But then who's paying their salaries? Who's creating their budgets? That's the legislature. And there are points in history where we can look at a direct link between the legislature cutting funding and more clients going to Lakeview because we don't have other options.
All right. A lot more of your questions and comments coming up. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're following up on an investigative program from NHPR and the radio show Reveal about the history of abuse and neglect at Lakeview Neurorehabilitation Center and other similar facilities around the country. Lakeview has since closed when these allegations came up and were investigated, but the clients it served are placed elsewhere in other facilities, sometimes not to their benefit. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. What is your experience broadly with New Hampshire's developmental disability system, mental health system? Where do you see facilities like Lakeview fitting into that system? 1-800-892-6477 is our number here in The Exchange. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. With me in studio, Jack Rodalino, NHPR's health reporter. He has been covering this Lakeview issue for over a year and has co-reported an hour-long investigative program on it with the program Reveal. Kurt Decker joins us from Washington, executive director of the National Disability Rights Network. That's the membership organization for local groups like the New Hampshire Disability Rights Center, which has been involved in this Lakeview issue. One more time, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. And Jack and Kurt, right back to our listeners. Steve's in Nottingham. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
I'm a psychiatrist. I actually want to make 3 points. Number one, the population you're describing is incredibly difficult to treat. They need incredible, when you talk about one-to-one care, if you've ever worked with this population, you realize it's Herculean for the staff to do, number one. Number two, I dislike the term that has been used that at certain points people will warehouse. I work in state facilities, and they were not warehoused. They were given incredibly good care by state workers who give care, and that compassion is lost in that wild term saying they were warehoused. Number three is that what we're talking about is a failure of the community mental health system. When I became a psychiatrist, it was Kennedy and Johnson that invoked and had this community mental health system where people were treated in their community regardless of income. I would like to see us return to that type of standard where people are treated closer to home by people in their community.
Well, Steve, it's great to hear from you. And Kurt, your thoughts on some of the points that Steve raises.
Well, I certainly could agree with the latter one about keeping people in their own communities where their families and other people can monitor their behavior. I totally disagree with his concept. Unfortunately, he may have had a good experience where in the facility that he worked in, but we see facilities across the country where warehouse is probably a kind word. We've had people who have been, as Jack reported, sexually abused, murdered. In Texas, we found institutions where staff were having people engage in a fight club mentality and filming it with their cell phones, which is the only way we happen to find out about it.
Because
yikes. Of the cell phone. So there is just a long-standing decade history of abuse in these large congregate facilities, which had them closed down.
Kurt, was that the case at the older form of state-run facilities that we used to see? Because I think Steve mentioned, you know, state-run facilities.
Yes.
It happens everywhere.
Definitely, but I'm a realist. I don't believe in moving people out of big, bad places and putting them into small, bad places. There is a responsibility, and my organizations try to follow folks out of the larger facilities into the community to assure that whether it's a public or private provider, that the care is better. I do agree with Tom that many of these people have very severe disabilities and a real challenge to care. But I would think that they could be cared for more appropriately in smaller settings than, as Jack described, where there's one staff for three or four or more people. So getting people into smaller places with the proper staff, trained, supported, is really the best answer. But it requires constant vigilance to make sure that those services are in place.
Well, and some parents were upset when Lakeview closed. They felt like they had gotten good care there. They weren't sure what they would do next. We talked about this in the exchange back in March after, Jack, your first round of reporting on the topic and a new report from the New Hampshire Disabilities Rights Center. During that program, a parent named Ed called in all the way from Oregon to share his positive experience with Lakeview. Ed said his son was autistic and had been very successful at Lakeview for several years.
We've read the report rather my wife and I have read the report rather extensively. You know, frankly, the Disability Rights Center has an agenda to move this kind of care locally. And I can tell you from our experience here in Oregon, there is really no local facility like Lakeview that can provide the kind of treatment that he's getting. So we did a nationwide search looking for places, and the place that came up at the top of the list was Lakeview, and he's been very successful there. Frankly, here in Oregon, we have our choice of facility, either one that has razor wire or one that has barbed wire.
Again, that's a caller to our program back in March talking about his positive experience at Lakeview. What do you think, Kurt? He said that he feels like the disability rights groups like yours have an agenda to get people locally, and sometimes local options aren't very good.
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with having an agenda if it's a good agenda. We definitely want states to develop the facilities and the services within their own borders to treat people with disabilities. I sympathize with him. Why does not Oregon have those kind of facilities? There's nothing magic about putting it in New Hampshire. Oregon should be developing a continuum of services to treat the range of people with disabilities based on the manifestations of their disability, whether it's traumatic brain injury, whether it's psychiatric disabilities or intellectual disabilities. Oregon has had some success in developing a range of facilities, but again, it sounds like they have not really created that continuum to take people at the level of the service they need. Why should a parent have to send someone from Oregon to New Hampshire? That is a failure of the service system to respond. And I guess I would question how often that father could get to New Hampshire from Oregon to see whether his son was doing as well as he was being told.
Well, and here's a question for you, Jack Rodolico. So again, Lakeview closes. Where do those folks go, especially the New Hampshire folks? Are we seeing now, you know, New Hampshire former residents at Lakeview going to far-flung states where the parents can't keep a closer eye?
It's hard to say because Lakeview is a private company, you know, they never gave us a list of their clients and where they're from and their parents' phone numbers, right? So I know where some have gone. Several have gone to these group homes in Madison and a few other parts of the state. Some have gone to at least one has gone to a facility in Massachusetts. One has gone to a facility in Florida. We know also that when Governor Hassan was the first one to take a big step here, she shut down new admissions to Lakeview a little over a year ago. When that happened, we had a backlog. People that couldn't get to Lakeview, so where did they go? You know, a report from her office found that they were increasingly winding up in, again, inappropriate places like jails, like Ed from Oregon said, psychiatric units, or nursing homes. Nursing homes, there's tens of thousands of people with disabilities in nursing homes in the United States.
Non-elderly people.
Well, elderly and non-elderly, yeah, that are just stuck in nursing homes because they don't have a better place to go.
Some of the conversation around where these folks would go did center on another facility connected to Lakeview, Jack, and help me out with this, in Florida called Finer Florida
Institute for Neurological Rehabilitation.
Okay, so what's the connection between, as you guys put it in your reveal story, the mountain and the swamp?
Finer is owned by the same family that founded Lakeview. It's as simple as that. And so, you know, both Finer in Florida, this is Wachula, Florida. I mean, it's really a remote place surrounded by thousands of acres of swampland. Probably more remote than Lakeview was. Those two facilities were part of the 43 facilities that this huge company, New Medico, owned and operated. And so the patriarch of this family and the patriarch of the company was Charles Brennick. And Charles Brennick was sort of this larger-than-life character. There's a lot of stories about Charles Brennick, but essentially he got into a lot of trouble with Congress and the FBI. There was never an indictment. There was never a prosecution, even though there was rampant evidence of abuse and fraud by New Medico. The FBI said they didn't feel they could pin it on the top officials, which included Charles Brennick and one of his sons, Joe Brennick. when New Medico got into trouble, they sold off their facilities. The one in New Hampshire, which was originally the Brennecks' summer home, it was their vacation home, wound up ultimately in the hands of Lakeview. The one in Florida wound up in the hands of Charles Brennick's son, Joe Brennick. Joe Brennick has the Florida facility. If you want to know about that place, Google it. The stories that have come out of there are horrific.
And Florida has not shut it down like New Hampshire shut down Lakeview.
No. In fact, Florida has less regulatory authority over Finer than New Hampshire did over Lakeview. Do you want to?
Let's hear a little bit. Your partner in the Reveal project spoke to the owner, Joseph Brennick, of this sort of partner, sister organization, if I could call it that, or facility. Here's Joseph Brennick. She asked him, you know, what do you say to those who might have heard about the record, might have heard about the investigations, and are concerned about sending your loved ones to Finer? Let's hear what Joseph Brennick says.
Come on down and tour. Look at your options. Go tour other facilities. See what they offer you. See if they're even willing to take you.
See if they're even willing to take you. That's part of the issue, isn't it, Kurt Decker? I mean, sometimes folks who come to these facilities do have a complicated set of issues, and they feel like they don't have any other choice.
As I said earlier, I certainly have great sympathy for families who are struggling with a relative with a disability that is really has some major problems. So this is catnip to them. They're desperate. They're looking for a place, and they want to rely on the assurances of these people. Finer is a great example. They'll fly people down, take them to Disneyland, have a great marketing campaign to try to make the families feel like this is going to be a great place. If you go to the John Rottenberg Center in Rhode Island, you'll see, you know, cute little drawings on the walls and cartoon characters, all in an attempt to, you know, assuage families' fears that that they're somehow abandoning their child. So it puts the families in a difficult position, but they're desperate, and some of these folks take advantage of that desperation.
Jack, go ahead.
Just a couple things about how this works, right? So New Hampshire currently has 11 residents with developmental disabilities at Finer.
Wow, that's a lot.
It's a lot. It's approximately the same number that we averaged at Lakeview. We had a little bit more than that at Lakeview. And so while the state has gone to these great efforts to shut down Lakeview, we're still relying on a facility in Florida farther away that we can't possibly provide as much oversight of. Now, I should say, I talked to the area agencies. I talked to the state. These are good people who work for the state and for these nonprofits who want to help people with disabilities. And they're doing that the best that they can. They're trying to build a network of care in the state. But until that happens, we've got 11 people at a facility with a worse track record than Lakeview.
This is Finer.
This is Finer, yeah. In Florida, Florida Institute for Neurological Rehabilitation. And somebody used this word, you've heard this term a lot, dumping ground, that these facilities wind up being a dumping ground. Okay, Finer has people with a huge spectrum of neurological conditions, people that really in almost no setting should be treated in the same place. Finer has got people with developmental disabilities from New Hampshire, mental illness from Connecticut, brain injuries from Michigan, totally different conditions with totally different treatment spectrums. At one point, Finer had foster kids from the District of Columbia. So they wind up, when states are overburdened
and
they don't have enough funding and desperate for a place for someone they don't quite know what to do with, a place like Finer steps in and says, hey, we're the experts. And you know, when they get sued, they settle out of court. You know, the states don't really have that much authority to do much about it. Even when they do have authority, they sometimes don't.
Let's take one more call, gentlemen. And David's in Portsmouth. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi, thank you. I'm the attorney for Amy, who was one of the victims at Lakeview that was in Jack's story.
Wow.
Jack just made the comment that most people can't afford to sue and they settle. My client sued. She didn't settle. We took it to a jury and we won. In the course of that case, we got sworn testimony from employees of Lakeview who admitted to fraud and mistreatment. We turned it all over to the state, and the state did nothing. So, unfortunately, the state employees are immune from liability, but that doesn't make them not responsible ethically and morally.
When did you turn over all this information, David?
Well, Jack has the information, and it's all available through his investigation, but it was on the heels of the verdict, which was in the 90s.
2000. Yeah, 2000 was when you sent your letter to the state.
Thank you.
Yeah, so, David, and I apologize. I'm so glad you called. We are running short of time. So now what? I mean, given your involvement, given your history in this, what do you want to happen next?
Well, the state needs to have meaningful oversight. I've been involved in disability rights since I was a legal aid attorney in 1975 in New Hampshire. And sadly, I haven't seen any change in the way the state gives oversight of people who have treatment under state auspices, either licensing, either by the state directly or indirectly in homes that are licensed by the state.
And why do you think that's the case, David?
Out of sight, out of mind, plus New Hampshire prides itself on having a low tax burden, and they don't want to pay for the costs that would be involved.
David, thank you so much for calling in. Gentlemen, we're running close to the end. Kurt, quick thoughts from you as we wrap up.
Just that I couldn't agree more with what David just said. We have worked for years to try to convince at the federal level and at the state level to build a stronger monitoring oversight system. We've had some success in some places, but clearly what's been said in this program just demonstrates the need for this kind of constant vigilance to make sure this vulnerable population is protected.
And in terms of what's next here in New Hampshire, Jack, what are you going to be following up on in terms of whether the Lakeview facility is reopened, rebranded, Lakeview 2.0 as a substance
Lakeview
abuse.
3 or 4.0 at this point, yeah.
Right,
Substance abuse. We're going to see what happens. I mean, I'm going to be going to legislators and the Department of Health and Human Services and just asking them, what are your thoughts on this facility trying to reopen? And in the meantime, you know, we'll try to follow people who have mental illness and who have developmental disabilities and see if and when they're falling through the cracks.
Okay. Jack, thank you so much for being here and for all the work that you've done.
Thanks for doing the show.
Jack Rodolico, NHPR's health reporter. Again, he's been reporting on Lakeview for a year. On our website, nhpr.org/exchange, we'll put up links to all the work that Jack has done. Kurt Decker, it was great to have you, too. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Kurt Decker, Executive Director of the National Disabilities Rights Network. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Daniel Wazinski-Larson. Our intern is Hallie Loft. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.